Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Michael Gross. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Jessica Bowers. This case, this appeal arises from a judgment in a dissolution of marriage case, which also made an award of primary physical custody and sole legal custody in favor of a non-biological, non-adoptive parent, and against a biological parent, the biological mother. The case is significant for that reason, because historically, by statute and by common law, and by common sense, Missouri has ascribed great importance to the relationship of a natural parent to her or his child. And in this case, there is a presumption that's been recognized in Section 452.375 that the natural parent is fit to take care of his or her child. There is a historical common law presumption to the same effect. And the effect of this decision, Judge Page in the Court of Appeals felt that the effect of the majority decision would be to authorize equitable parentage. I suspect that after the decision in this case, that question will be cleared up. I don't know whether it authorizes equitable parentage in contravention of what this court has said previously or not. But it does undermine that presumption of fitness, that favoring of natural parent.
The trial judge in this case didn't base its decision on equitable parentage, and the trial judge in this case found that neither biological parent was fit, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So what would be the legal options based upon the record for the trial judge if those findings are supported?
That depends in part on the proper interpretation of Section 452.375 with respect to awards to third parties. My position would be that Mr. Bowers was a third party. He's an ex-stepfather at the point at which they become Mr. Bowers and Mrs. Bowers are divorced. He's not a biological parent, and he's not an adoptive parent. He was, his relationship with the child, it's an established judicial fact at this point, his relationship with the child is an important relationship for the child's welfare. He ought to be in the child's life. I'm not here to contest that. Mrs. Bowers felt otherwise and litigated her position in the circuit court. She litigated it aggressively, that she thought it was best for the child not to have Mr. Bowers in her life any longer. And that's what she tried to accomplish. She failed. She made it clear in her testimony in the trial court, and two witnesses whom the trial court found credible, that would be the Dr. Duncan Hively and Ms. Coulter, the court-appointed. Dr. Duncan Hively was a court-appointed therapist, and Ms. Coulter was the court-appointed GAL. Both testified and were found credible by the court that despite her position in the litigation, despite the bumps in the road during the course of the litigation, that Mrs. Bowers would abide by a court order that provided what access to the child and what relationship to the child Mr. Bowers would have.
But she didn't throughout the proceeding. I mean, she violated several court orders.
Over the course of 2 years of separation, what the evidence established was that, according to Mr. Bowers, on six or seven occasions, she kept the child for a day or two longer than she was supposed to keep the child. And the context of that, according to Mr. Bowers, was that they would trade days. That she would agree with him to trade days. She would take his day or two, and then she was to repay him that day or two, and she didn't. That was one category, and he said that happened six or seven times over the course of 2 years. The second category of his complaint was that over one Christmas holiday, he was to have the child for three or four days, and he didn't get the child for those three or four days. It is significant. Mrs. Bowers recognizes that and wouldn't begin to suggest otherwise, that the court ordered equal division of the child was violated. But the point here that I want to make for the court is that is not a significant, as important as it is that there be compliance, That is not enough to overcome the presumption of fitness.
So you're saying there was not evidence to show the mother was unfit, unsuitable, or unable to be custodian, or the welfare of the child required third-party custody. What in addition, opposing counsel is going to get up, and I know we'll take the opposite position. So tell me why you think there was not sufficient evidence.
That is best done, I think, by trying to break down the trial court's categories of findings of unfitness. So the first finding the trial court made, and the only finding the trial court made in its original judgment, in which it found Mrs. Bowers unfit for this reason, was that she failed to get medical attention for the child after the child had a seizure. That is absolutely unsupported by any evidence. It is contradicted by the only evidence on the point. Dr. Duncan Hively testified that both parents took the child to the hospital immediately after she suffered a seizure. There is no evidence to the contrary. The second category of finding, which appears for the first time in the addendum to the court's judgment.
What's the significance that it appears in the addendum?
I think the significance is that the court was prepared to find the mother unfit and only found the mother unfit in its original judgment because of a fact that didn't exist.
But we don't look at the original judgment, we look at the final judgment.
For interpreting, for determining whether the court abused its discretion or whether the court had a sufficient basis for certain findings, I thought it might be helpful. I still think it might be helpful, but of course, I stand corrected, that the court was prepared to find Mrs. Bowers unfit because of a fact that didn't exist. If that's insignificant, then I'm sorry for taking up the court's time with it. The other two categories also are not supported, are against the weight of the evidence. That one is supported by no evidence. The major category, as recognized by Judge Page and as reading of the judgments will reflect, was that what had to do with the acrimonious relationship between Mrs. Bowers and Mr. Bowers. There was indeed an acrimonious relationship. She did indeed take the position and litigate the position that she thought it was best for the child, despite her recognition that it would be a loss and a significant loss for the child to not have that relationship, that it was best for the child to not have Mr. Bowers in her life. Her explanation boiled down to her testimony that she didn't think it was proper for the child to think that a man can treat her the way that she had been treated by Mr. Bowers. She litigated that position. She was wrong. The trial court made a finding, and the Court of Appeals has affirmed that findings in various ways. And I'm not here to argue that the court erred in rejecting Mrs. Bowers' position about what was best for the child. But that's all she did, is she tried to get the natural father excluded. She also testified, and her testimony was found not credible, so it's not important. But I'll tell you what testimony is important. But Mrs. Bowers testified, if there's a court order that says this is what his relationship is and this is what his access is, I will abide by the court order. Dr. Duncan Hively and Ms. Coulter, both of whom were found credible by the trial court, testified to the same thing. They both testified that they believed she would abide by whatever the court order was. And the court made a finding in its original judgment and in its addendum to that judgment, that she would require a judgment that said here's what the relationship and access of Mr. Bowers is. Well, you'd expect that there would be an order, that there is no burden on anybody to have an order that says here's what each parent's access to the child is going to be, and here's what the legal custody decision is going to be. That would be the order. Whether there was this contest or not, there would eventually have been an order that said, here's what legal custody is going to be, and here's what physical custody is going to be. And everybody basically said, whatever that order is, she's going to abide by it. She got punished. And more importantly, the child got punished. by a judgment that overrides a presumption of her fitness. She was found unfit because of these things that we've been talking about, which boil down to there's a third category I haven't addressed yet, but boil down to the failure to provide medical attention, which would be incredibly important if it was true, but it didn't happen. And because of her acrimonious relationship with Mr. Bowers, which she demonstrated by improperly violating court orders in a way that wasn't sufficient to justify overcoming the presumption of her fitness.
So you would agree there would be no way that the court could ever order a joint legal custody situation because of their acrimonious relationship?
I don't think I understood the question.
There would be no evidence to support the trial court ordering a joint arrangement between the parties with the child.
There was ample evidence in this case that would have supported an award of joint legal custody.
Despite their acrimonious relationship?
Yes. My position would be that the overriding fact is that for 2 years, they co-parented. They had bumps in the road. There were 6 or 7 times when she kept the child a day or two too long. There was a Christmas where she kept the child too long. She was ultimately found in contempt of court. There's no pending litigation. There's no indication. She still has the child 5 days out of every 14. And there's no indication that she's not abiding by court orders. That's not part of the record. But what is in the record is, and I don't mean to diminish the significance of violating court orders, but there are violations of court orders, and there are violations of court orders. And what she did was a relatively minor, and ultimately corrected attitude of I can keep the child a few extra days if I want to. That doesn't overcome her right to her the preference of her as the legal custodian of her child. She is excluded from legal custody of her child. She's the only biological parent in the picture.
Mr. Gross, you're out of time. While you're opposing counsel, I want to give you an opportunity on rebuttal to explain to me how you think point number one complies with the rules regarding points relied on.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yep.
May it please the court. There really shouldn't be any question about the result in the trial court. Ultimately, Judge Hogan got custody right. Mr. Bowers, who I refer to as Dad, it's a little different from the summary on the court website, but he has legal custody of his little girl, JC. Depending on how you characterize it, he either has sole physical custody or he's the residential parent in a joint physical custody situation. But there really shouldn't be any dispute that despite how Judge Hogan may have gotten there, the outcome is right. The trial court determined that Mom was unfit to have sole legal and sole physical custody. Query whether that would apply to joint physical and an award of joint physical after having determined whether she's unfit to have sole physical. But be that as it may, Judge Hogan saw, quite frankly, during this 2-day trial, right through everything that was going on. The ploy to bring Mr. Nugent into it, who had never had any contact with this child, she saw, and I think rightly so, as an effort to interfere with the relationship between JC and Mr. Bowers.
We know there is precedent in cases that says interference in a relationship with another parent's contact with the child or relationship with the child justifies an award of custody. Are there cases that find it justifies a determination of unfitness?
I have not seen one, Your Honor. I do know that one of the cases that we referred to in our brief talked about an individual who cultivated the relationship between an individual who was the non-biological father and the child, and determined that she would not then be allowed to extinguish that by her actions. I can't recall off the top of my head whether that resulted in a termination or just an award of custody, but I think the I think it could potentially apply in a situation. We're not talking about a termination, though. We're saying that she is unfit to have custody, and I think Mr. Gross has glossed over a few other things that influenced Judge Hogan's decision. One of the things that she looked at was not just keeping the child extra time, but she also paid some attention to the fact that Ms. Bowers seemed to have serial boyfriends. And every time she had a new boyfriend involved in the case, she tried to introduce the child and, in essence, have a substitute father. And that was one of the things that she relied upon. She saw this as a problem, as an effort to interfere with that relationship between Mr. Bowers and the child. So it goes beyond just not bringing the child back at a particular time or keeping the child some extra days.
And are there other categories of evidence? What about the medical attention issue? Is there any evidence to support that?
Off the top of my head, I can't recall anything specifically in that regard. I know the finding was there. I did not go back to determine whether the testimony reflected that. I do think also that Judge Hogan's assessment, I mean, this kind of reminds me of asking Vladimir Putin, did you interfere? And if he says no, well, okay, we'll work with that. Asking mom, will you abide by court orders? Well, I really don't expect that she'd say no. Of course she'd say yes. Judge Hogan, however, came to the conclusion that that wasn't necessarily believable. She had serious concerns about Ms. Bowers and her future actions in terms of abiding by court orders and fostering the relationship.
How does that gel with then allowing her visitation, you know, substantial visitation, where obviously then she's going to have to give the child back? Wouldn't you run into those same issues? How does that address? If she's unsuitable because she's not going to abide by the court order, then why did the court find it's okay for her to have custody or visitation, substantial visitation?
I think it's key that the court and the Court of Appeals opinion as well focused on the fact that she was found unfit to have sole legal and sole physical custody. And the statute really doesn't talk about that. But I think that that may have been what this keyed on, was that, well, we're not going to give her sole physical custody because we're not going to give her that kind of control, and we're not going to give her sole legal custody because we don't want her making decisions with regard to the child. As has been brought out, I think the evidence was such that it's very understandable that the two of these people can't make decisions with regard to each other. So I think the schedule is probably what's in the child's best interest as we sit here. Unfortunately, science has overtaken the law here. If you go back the centuries, if you had a situation where somebody got married after the child was there and the child was acknowledged to be that person's child, there wouldn't be any question about it. We didn't have blood tests, we didn't have DNA, we didn't have human genome sequencing and all of that. And so now we're caught up in a situation where somebody went out and got a blood test after Mr. Bowers is already on the birth certificate, he's already done everything anyone could contemplate as being father, and now we're trying to figure out how to shoehorn that into this statute.
And it seems to me that part of that problem is procedural. If the paternity issue had been tried separately and first, it seems to me there would have been no trouble affirming a conclusion that Jason was the father for purposes of that proceeding. If the divorce had then been tried, you would have had the father and the mother, and it would have been just like any other divorce, and the standards would have been just like any other case.
You ain't going to have any argument for me here.
Well,
and unfortunately, but that, the horse is already out of the barn on this. Unlike the Saeed case, in which the trial court held the custody issue in abeyance. There had already been a determination of parentage. We have a situation where it all got tried together. And, you know, I mean, Judge Hogan sent out the invitations and everybody showed up and they had a party. There wasn't anybody excluded. Everybody was there and all the evidence was taken. I agree with you, Judge. If this had been a situation where the formalities of the operating rule had been followed, we probably would not be as confused as we are today in terms of trying to figure out how all this works. Should we
try to enforce the operating rule with the belief that had it been followed, and if it were followed, you would have a result that comports with the judgment we have? Or should we try to reverse engineer the judgment and change the substantive outcome because the process wasn't filed? That's what I'm wrestling with.
I think from a judicial economy perspective, reverse engineering this was probably the way to go. I mean, even Judge Page, who sent this up here, didn't have any dispute with the result. She thought this was the right result based on the evidence. It was just different T's were crossed and different I's should have been dotted. And I think it certainly provided a roadmap as to what could have been done. I do think the argument about the third party problem as in Saeed, I think it does raises an issue in terms of how the statute is to be construed. Because I think when the legislature wrote that, they were thinking of third parties in the context of you've got a mom, you've got a dad. They weren't thinking third parties, oh, well, we've got a dad and we've got a stepfather, and if somebody else is going to come in and have custody, they have to be necessarily added as a third party in a different proceeding.
But we've had stepfathers for a long time, and that's, I think, is...
And we determine parentage in divorces for a long time.
I'm sorry?
Determining parentage in a divorce is continual, it's constant. It may be implied, but it's not... It's not irrelevant.
Well, and to Judge Powell's question or observation, yes, we have had stepfathers for a long time. And before we had the science to determine whether, in fact, an actual stepfather who held himself out, not only he, but the mother and the child, considered the actual father, stepfathers were just treated as fathers. And now we've got the problem of the science coming in.
But the third party... custody statute wasn't, doesn't appear to be designed for stepfathers. It seems to be who's going through a divorce and wants to get some custody and some visitation of a child that he may have helped raise for years. It seems to contemplate something of a completely third party, like a grandparent or aunt and uncle or something like that.
Well, I don't think it's limited to that. I agree with you that there's probably a lot of those cases. We're going to have more of those cases. In fact, there's one out of the Eastern District that has recently gotten decided. I suspect you all may be dealing with it, where two women are addressing the question of their relationship and custody and parentage of the child there. And that case implemented TQL and gave the non-biological mom some custody rights. I suspect that's going to be up here too, and we're going to be addressing that. I think over time some of that's going to flush out. But to say that a third party has to be joined as opposed to already being part of the litigation, I think can lead to even more absurd results. I can contemplate a situation, for example, where grandparents are already part of the case because of property issues, and that's not uncommon. You know, grandma's on the property, or there's a trust account, or something along those lines. So they're already part of the litigation. They may also be appropriate for custody under 452.375 under the Saeed interpretation and the interpretation of mom. They couldn't be given any custody rights either because they're already part of the litigation.
Now,
at least
Saeed
not within
still,
that context.
I'm sorry, is Saeed still good law? I mean,
I don't
light
think
of
it is.
TQL coming down later?
I don't think it is, Your Honor. I don't know, were you thinking of Saeed when you wrote TQL? I cannot imagine that it is. I think TQL is pretty clear that under certain circumstances you can state a cause of action for custody of a child, and that is for the best interests of the child here, not necessarily for Mr. Bowers or Mrs. Bowers, but for the child. And Dr. Duncan Hively indicated, it would be devastating to the child to have Mr. Bowers taken out of this case.
Are you in effect arguing that this should be affirmed based on it being the welfare of the child requires it, as opposed to mother being unfit and unsuitable?
The trial court didn't really get into that. I think if you read the judgment, I think you could certainly infer that that's what was going on. There's been a lot of discussion as to what exactly welfare of the child requires or demands means. Is it, you know, can you take best interests and just take the definitions and move them, and then they in essence are the same thing? It's a word salad, or is it best interest plus? But it's part of the statute, and I think that's part of what I think Judge Page overlooked, because she equated welfare of the child demands with equitable parentage. One of the things about equitable parentage is, as you indicated, Judge Russell, in TQL, you didn't address that. You didn't say whether it was good law, bad law, whether we have it, whether we don't have it. You specifically said we're not going to talk about that.
Well, the trial court said it was third-party custody. It didn't go on equitable parentage.
And it didn't go there. But interestingly enough, that wasn't raised in the post-trial motion, that finding was not made. And I think under 7807, that would have to be, because you'd have to give Judge Hogan the ability, if that's what all this hinges on, to at least have let her rule on that. That's why 7807 was adopted. And that wasn't part of the initial motion for a new trial. And if the attachment to the judgment results in an amended judgment, there was no post-trial motion with regard to that. So that was never raised to the trial court. So I think to that extent, that issue is waived. I think we can assume that that may be where she's going, but raising that as an issue that wasn't part of it, I think it's gone. And I would ask that the judgment be affirmed. Thank you.
Mr. Gross, I'm sure you're familiar with the numerous cases over the last couple of years that have said that a lack of substantial evidence and against the weight of the evidence are two separate claims on appeal have to be brought in separate points relied on. And if I look at those cases and I compare your point number one, it looks like you've raised at least six different claims in your point one, which seems to be multifarious to me, and I want to give you an opportunity to explain.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor, for the opportunity. I am familiar with those decisions. I think that the point relied on does raise a viable issue for this court. The determination that's challenged in the point is the determination that she's unfit and should be excluded from that it's appropriate to exclude her from legal custody because she's an unfit parent. That finding of unfitness and the appropriateness of excluding her from participating in the educational, religious, medical, and general welfare decisions in the child's upbringing was based on a subset of findings. The first category was the medical finding, for which there's no evidence whatsoever. The second category was the findings related to the acrimonious relationship, for which there was evidence that she wanted to terminate the child's access to Mr. Bowers. And the third category is escaping me, there was evidence, but the weight of the evidence was not sufficient to overcome the presumption of fitness. What this appeal is about, from Mrs. Bowers' point of view, is that she has been excluded from any control in the religious, medical, general health, education, and welfare decisions of her biological child in favor of a man who is neither didn't adopt the child and wasn't the biological, or what we would contend is the natural parent. Even under the statutes, he's not the natural parent. There's a presumption.
And he probably didn't adopt the child because of the certificate of parentage, right?
That may well be.
Because he was on the birth certificate.
And that I would assume that that's correct. But the fact is, He's not the biological. In a different case, that would be determinative. The presumption that that arises that he is the natural parent would be determinative. But this isn't that case.
Well, counsel, how would your argument be any different if they had tried the paternity issue first, if he had been determined to be the father, and then we'd have had a normal divorce where the issue of custody and visitation would have been litigated between two parents, both indisputably parents?
I think the argument might be different because he might not be found to be the natural father. Now, Section 210.834 suggests to me, as noted by Judge Page in her dissent, that the presumption of parentage that arises from DNA testing is conclusive, and that's the end of the story. And I'm out of time again. I don't want to impose on the court. But if the outcome had been that Mr. Bowers was not the natural father, then my argument would be I'm not here to argue. I don't want to argue what his entitlement is, except that it's not to have sole legal custody.
Would your argument be the same if the trial court had found that the welfare of the child requires the determination that he has sole custody? Would your same arguments apply?
The argument would be somewhat different because I'd have to overcome the Section 452.375.5 provides for an award to a third party either if the both natural parents are unfit, or if there's some extraordinary circumstance such that the welfare of the child demands a custody award to Mr. Bowers. And I think the outcome, if Mr. in that situation, would be that under Section 452.375.5, Mr. Bowers might very well, in a finding that there could be a finding that the welfare of the child requires that he have some custody, that he be involved in the custody of the child. Welfare of the child could require that. But the welfare of the child can't require excluding Mrs. Bowers unless the evidence supports either a finding that she's unfit or a finding that the welfare requires her exclusion from legal custody. That's all I'm here about, is she's excluded from legal custody. She can't have any voice in those fundamental decisions about her child, and that's not consistent with Missouri law, common law, or statutory.
Thank you.